My guest today is a senior advisor and a former international advocacy director at Amnesty International. He's a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. Previously, he's been the UK director and UN advocacy director at Human Rights Watch. He's also been a journalist, reporting on the Eastern European revolutions, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the Balkan Wars. He studied Russian and German and speaks fluent Polish. With a particular interest in non-violent protest, he's written and broadcast on the theme of human rights for many years. And of course, he's an author. Steve Crawshaw, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Your most recent book, Street Spirit, The Power of Protest and Mischief, is all about the power of non-violent protest. And it's very much based on your own experiences from reporting on the East European revolutions, the collapse of the Soviet Union, as we say, the Balkan Wars, and of course, your work through both Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, interacting with activists around the globe. So it's a book based on a lifetime of hands-on experience. I want to go back to the beginning and the dawning of your own social conscience, if you like, and passion for human rights. Were your family campaigners?
My family weren't campaigners. My dad was a GP. I was a doctor. I grew up in rural West Dorset, and it was a liberal household, if you like, but certainly not human rights obsessed. I guess in a way it came through my interest in languages indirectly, really. So I was interested in languages, was doing German and French, then Russian was more exotic. It had wonderful literature, and of course it had really interesting and gritty politics, to put it mildly, at the time. This was deep in the era of the Cold War. So I was studying Russian. We're talking now in the 1970s. So I was interested in the twin weird things, if you like, going on. On the one hand, the Cold War, the Soviet bloc, and real repression and labor camps and things happening over there. And at the same time, in parallel, Latin America, you had right-wing dictatorships, people being tortured, disappeared, thrown from aeroplanes into the sea. So brutality of different kinds, left and right. And that was what I was very much, you know, came of age, if you like, in that era. I then lived in Russia as a student for a year, and again, lived in what seemed to be a Soviet empire that was just going to be there forever. We all assumed it was there forever. So I guess the real starting point for my fascination with nonviolent protest and what it can achieve was I was incredibly lucky, privileged just by pure chance, long before I became a journalist. In 1980, I was living in Poland. I had a scholarship to study theatre. I was also teaching English. And that was a time, Leonid Brezhnev, the hardline Soviet leader, was in power in Moscow. So this was way before Gorbachev, the reformist leader, was dreamed of. But what happened then was you had this group, it became known as Solidarity, a free trade union. They demanded a whole series of rights, which I've still got the cuttings from that time. Western commentators said, this is nuts. You are never going to get any of these things. Of course, the tanks will go in. And, you know, Soviet tanks had gone into Afghanistan. The previous year, they'd gone into Czechoslovakia only a decade earlier. Leonid Brezhnev himself was famous for what was called the Brezhnev Doctrine. If you do something out of line, we'll send the tanks in, basically. And in Poland, these people, with incredible good humor, mischief, and above all, incredible courage, they overturned those certainties. Solidarity became legal. Later, the tanks came in and stopped that. But that, when I was aged 25, it set me up thinking, wow, these people who think they know everything about things that will never change, it kind of just did. And it became clear that lots more would change in the years to come. Mm.
And of course it did. And you had a front seat for all of this, particularly when you were working as a journalist.
Yeah, exactly. So again, I was incredibly privileged. When I came back from Poland, I became a journalist, did various things then, including working for Granada Television in Manchester, which was very strong in its current affairs, and worked there. And then was terribly lucky. I joined The Independent when it launched in 1986. And those were, you know, fantastic days to be there. We meet up sometimes. We had a 30th anniversary celebration the other day and remain great friends with many of those at that very exciting time. Very important for foreign affairs, South Africa, Eastern Europe, elsewhere, lots happening. And again, I was so lucky. I was asked at the very end of 1988 to become the East Europe editor for The Independent. Bizarrely, in retrospect, I thought, oh, maybe I won't do that. I've done East Europe for so long. And I was about to become Madrid correspondent. And I'm so grateful to the then deputy foreign editor, Nick Ashford, who said, well, I think this is a really important time. And I said, yes, it is. You're right. So I became the East Europe editor, which meant looking after all of our coverage throughout the region. Based in London, we had stringers, a team of stringers through the region, but would travel East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary, the Baltic states, Moscow itself. And it was so interesting to see what was coming, especially when the politicians clearly had no idea what was coming. They were obsessed with the one guy at the top, Mikhail Gorbachev in the Kremlin. Will he survive or not? I was way more interested in the kind of changing pulse on the streets and in the homes of people in different places. And if you looked at those bits, I quite quickly, from early 1989 onwards, became kind of almost obsessed, as some colleagues will remember, saying the whole thing's crumbling. So until 1988, I thought, it'll all stay the same. In any case, you know, what can change, really? It doesn't change. And then I suddenly realized that, partly because of Gorbachev, to be fair, but actually also despite him, there was going to be a whole wave of change. And that was very exciting to live through.
And of course, that's documented, a lot of it, in your book, Goodbye to the USSR, the collapse of Soviet power.
Exactly.
If you could put your finger on one thing that made the absolute difference there, what do you think it was?
Well, I would go back to Poland as the kind of the starting point. So when Gorbachev came to power in 1985, was chosen by a bunch of hardliners, Poland was this grit that was there. There were economic problems, but there were also these restive Poles who were refusing to lie down, as it were. And I tell a couple of stories of the kind of the mischief that goes with that in the book. So on the one hand, there was Poland, which was restive. There was Hungary, which was also very quiet, but was also going, actually, let's go in a completely different direction. There it came a little bit more from the top, a reformist communist leaders who were, again, absolutely overturning the certainties of previous years. But if there's one moment which will remain with me to my dying day, it was actually in the Baltic states. I was there in March 1989. There were some upcoming national Soviet elections that were coming up, and so the elections in every one of the Soviet republics. The Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania were at that time all part of the Soviet Union, having been annexed, crucially, by Stalin after a deal with Hitler, which Moscow completely denied. So annexed in 1940, kept in 1945, and they resented it so much, but they obviously had been suppressed. And you weren't even allowed to talk about the fact that it had been annexed. It was allegedly a kind of, we walked into the fraternal arms of the Soviet troops and how marvelous it was. No, it was not like that. Hundreds of thousands were sent to Siberian camps and so on and so forth. Decades of memory for the Balts, flatly denied by the Russian authorities. So I arrive in Tallinn, the Estonian capital, to do a standard piece about, reformist place, what's happening in these elections. I knew there was a group that was kind of pressing for more autonomy and economic this and economic that, and it was kind of very interesting. And I sit down with somebody who's a political editor for a then still Soviet TV station, and he explains to me everything that's going on, and it's so extraordinary. I say at the end, I don't quite understand, because everything you've described to me, it kind of leads to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So unthinkable at that time. It actually collapsed 2 years later, but at that time, beyond unthinkable. And he said, the Roman Empire lasted. It was supposed to last forever. The Third Reich was going to last for 1,000 years. And, now this one's falling apart. I go, right, okay, that's pretty amazing. Scribbling in my notebook with... Really, I can still remember the goosebumps of the extraordinariness, because it was kind of already a conclusion. I said, are you really that sure? Because that's a pretty amazing thing to say. And he said, if you really want to, I'll say I'm not sure, but I really, really hope. Again, remember, this is a Soviet senior journalist. And I said, okay, that's even more extraordinary. At the end, I say, thank you so much for the conversation. That was great. And obviously, this is all off the record. I obviously am not going to quote you by name. And he said, why would you not quote me by name? That's absolutely fine. So that moment of you guys have lost all fear. And a later conversation that day, I put the same questions. And she's, again, a very distinguished person, quoted by name, said, maybe the tanks might come in, but that would be the last flick of the dragon's tail. And all of that proved exactly right. And that was, in a sense, the starting point for the book that you mentioned, Goodbye to the USSR, where before it collapsed, I kind of laid out why it was bound to collapse for some of those reasons. So the things from below and throughout this period, the powerful Western politicians were not interested in any of that narrative. They were only interested in their counterparts who they spoke to. And that's what they really missed, I think.
Of course, you also went on to write about Germany with Easier Fatherland, all about changes in contemporary German society. Mm. Again, enormously interesting, looking at sort of three different distinct periods in German history.
Yeah. I've always been fascinated, and I remain fascinated by German changes That book was written in 2004, I guess. Today, in Britain and elsewhere, Germany is acknowledged as being a kind of moral leader. But at that time, people had great difficulty. It was like, yeah, well, there was the war, and then, like, okay, they pretend it's all over. Failed to understand that actually Germany had been so interesting. The extent of its confrontation with history and absorbing the truths into the very fabric of society had made it just an incredibly interesting society. So the book was structured, in a sense, around the history books. There's an institute in Germany that has all of the history books used since 1945, the whole lot for West Germany, Federal Republic of Germany. And in the 50s, it was full of denial. It was full of utter denial and kind of, oh, something happened, but we certainly didn't know. And it's actually really downplayed. And we are the victims of this narrative. In the 60s, it was like really bad stuff happened. There was this Auschwitz place. But, you know, it kind of, again, we didn't really know and ordinary people weren't involved. In the 70s was kind of much more breastbeating, and the 80s. And then at the time of unity, but actually in a sense, it was about different generations. So one was like the people who'd gone through it. They didn't want to know. Their children's generation, which in shorthand you can call the 1968 generation, was like, you guys have been telling lies to us. It was partly a violent rebellion, but then became a non-violent rebellion, demanding truth. And then for me, most interesting of all, the 90s and especially the 21st century, it was like, actually there's both. We helped to facilitate, by our lack of action in the 30s, let alone the 40s, people in Germany, citizens of Germany, helped to facilitate these bad things happen. If people had not done those things or had resisted, and there's wonderful examples in the modern school books of little individuals who did have impact, then things would have been so different. Mm. And that narrative is so built into the German DNA, and I wish, frankly, they could export it. I'm very interested in the Balkans during my East Europe work. Obviously, the Balkans and former Yugoslavia was important. And going back to Bosnia today, they so desperately need to have that confrontation with the past. In other words, for Bosnian Serbs to acknowledge the terrible, terrible crimes, genocide committed at Srebrenica. I was there a couple of years ago, still complete denial. So the contrast there between Germany understanding the importance of truth and gaining stability through truth, that was what really struck me most of all.
Yeah. Now, that whole theme of acts of resistance, small acts of resistance from individuals, is something that you carried on into your book that's in fact called that, Small Acts of Resistance, How Courage, Tenacity and Ingenuity Can Change the World. Now, this goes back to discussions we've been having, I think, for many years in my former incarnation, talking about non-violent change in Zimbabwe.
Exactly.
And that's one thing that I know you document in this book, but you also bring up many other instances of where that's worked and how it's worked.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, Zimbabwe is certainly a good example where there are lots of wonderfully mischievous ideas. And I think that's one of the threads of that book, and indeed of this book as well, is that often the courage of protest, of course, it's a serious business, but actually it's incredible how people who are taking the most incredible risks also show incredible humor at the same time. So the starting point of that book was a friend of mine, John Jackson. We knew each other from Burma work. He'd been involved with the Burma campaign when I was a journalist. We got to know each other pretty well. We were sitting over dinner in New York one evening, and he was already toying with these ideas of all these untold stories, which are really kind of funny and quite uplifting, but kind of get left out because they're never, quote, important enough to include in the newspaper stories, let alone in the history books. And both of us were aware of some nice stories. And that became the kind of kernel of it. And then we kind of multiplied those up. Again, it is kind of the theme of my life, but also an interest of John's as well. Poland and Burma both have lovely examples of such surreal mischief. And here are people being locked up. They're being beaten. They're, you know, facing the risk of death sometimes also. But certainly arrest and beating is kind of pretty much the norm. And yet keeping that humour that sort of unsettles the leaders in odd kind of ways. Mm. What Srdjan Popovic, the Serb, I was going to say opposition leader, but kind of protest leader, he was a leader of one of the key groups that helped end the rule of Slobodan Milosevic, the Serb leader, in 2000. He has this phrase, laftivism, which is a very nice phrase, and it describes what happened in Serbia, but also happens elsewhere, activism with laughter. And I find it so inspiring to see what happens with that.
Now, of course, as well as writing all of these books, you had your day job. So you've been very, very senior in Human Rights Watch and now in Amnesty International. I mean, that work obviously then brings you into contact with all of these people and all of these different forms of resistance.
Yeah.
How far in that job are you able to actively help with those acts?
First, you're absolutely right that that work kind of both influenced and reinforced. And it's kind of, again, I feel lucky in the work that I've done. I was incredibly privileged, I described, with the journalistic work and loved it. But then it was very interesting moving across to the NGO side, that in a way you could get involved in a different kind of way, still often talking to journalists and giving them stories which could be useful to them in their work. And of course, what you're doing on a daily basis, if you're working with a human rights organization, is meeting people who are at the sharp end. So you asked, you know, how much you can suggest things. I mean, the thing I always had to make clear, both with the first book, Small Acts of Resistance, and I'm guessing the question will also come up with Street Spirit, is, you know, is this a handbook for what people should be doing? Well, for those of us privileged enough to live in democracies, I'm very comfortable with it being treated as a quote-unquote handbook. If it's got nice ideas that you can steal, that's great. For those living in more repressive regimes, it would be insanely arrogant and quite disturbing if I were to describe it as a handbook, because the truth about many of these stories is, although they may be fun to read and although they may have had huge impact over the years, the other truth is that people are taking vast risks by doing it. So I can't sit in an armchair in London and say, oh, you should go and do this. And that's even more true with a human rights organization. So it's a little bit almost the other way around. I would say that I feel inspired by meeting. Some of the stories to hear are based on the work of people that I have seen and incredible things that they have done, which have often had impact for them. But again and again, and there are quotes like that come throughout the book, is that why would I regret that? Like, as one person from Azerbaijan says, the fact they locked me up for making this video which mocked the president with a donkey giving a press conference, and he was locked up for that. He said, well, that's okay, I was locked up because it proves that what I was doing was something that hurt them and made a difference. And so me being locked up is kind of part of the acknowledgement, if you like, of the importance of this kind of work.
I so identify with what you're saying about sitting in an armchair in London. I know certainly if, as the Zimbabwean diaspora, we're all like, why doesn't somebody do something? But this whole thing of being the first person to be brave enough to face the tanks, I mean, that's an incredible thing.
It is incredible. And obviously, social media is much discussed and still much mocked. I mean, perhaps slightly less now because people can see how it means very different things at different points. But certainly a few years ago, it's like, oh, what does all this Facebook stuff mean? It's just kind of irrelevant stuff when you're having a coffee and you click here and you click there. It's completely unengaged. One of the things that it has done, and in some ways it can, of course, be, you know, superficial, if you like, and so on and so forth. The phrase clicktivism is widely used. But one of the really interesting things, you say, the, you know, the individual person. So that one person standing in front of a tank famously in near Tiananmen Square after the massacre, taking incredible risks. We don't even know what happened to him. And again, you have individuals and people would go out on the street. They could not know if others were going to go out in the street or not. So you were just taking a collective risk, but for you, it was not collective, it was individual. In communist Eastern Europe, where I was, most people didn't have telephones even. So, but there was no way of working out. So it was like, until you went out, you didn't know whether you're going to be alone or whether there was going to be 100,000 people. And that was hugely important. Whereas today, life is still just as dangerous as we're seeing in many places around the world. But one interesting thing is that, for example, in Egypt, before the big protests and during the big protests in 2011, so many people had already signed up for the Facebook page, We Are All Khaled Said, someone who'd been killed by the security police a few months. And it's like, okay, I'm not alone. I can see there's 10,000, 20,000, 100,000, 200,000 others. And obviously it puts you into a psychologically different space. Mm. The risks are just as great or almost as great, slightly less great, obviously, if the crowd is very large, but still great. But it does give you that knowledge, which otherwise, including in Zimbabwe in past years, but also in communist Eastern Europe, elsewhere, the person makes an individual decision. It's like what's sometimes called the bungee jump. You're like, I'll do it, and I just kind of hope it'll be okay.
And of course, you document many of those stories in this latest book. It's called Street Spirit, The Power of Protest and Mischief. And it's wonderfully laid out. It has a foreword by Ai Weiwei, who says that change is not a matter of belief. It's as inevitable as evolution, which I love, love that quote. And the way it's laid out, just with one sort of story on each page with a fantastic photo, I think over 100 photographs
in this
book. Yeah. Some of the stories, though, are just wonderful, particularly the ones that involve humour. I like illegal gnomes.
Yes, it's again the one you've gone to again goes to Poland, which is kind of almost the king of these things in some ways. There are many others from many other countries. And thank you. I'm so glad that you like the look of it. I'm, of course, not directly responsible for the look. I'm so proud that it's come together in a way that it looks nice, but I would like to think that also has impact, because before even people have read the words, they look at the image and go, wow, that's kind of unusual. Then you read the caption, and then hopefully you read the story that goes with
great
it.
Great big rubber ducks instead of tanks.
Exactly. So that the famous tank man, and then how Chinese people managed to inserted with Photoshop yellow plastic ducks. And kind of, although it was such a serious subject, it was on the anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre, they were kind of both laughing at the censors and getting past the censors because, briefly anyway, yellow plastic duck wasn't a banned phrase. Quickly, it did become a banned phrase, which was quite fun itself. So you asked about you mentioned the Polish one. Yeah, it's that sense of complete mischief, of a kind of slightly surreal humour, which I enjoyed when I was living in Poland. I enjoyed when going back and working and enjoy now looking back at, and indeed is needed again today. Poland is in a difficult space again today. So that was a story about how a group called the Orange Alternative, which I'm very, very fond of, they in general had surreal protests. One was, for example, we protested too much against the regime, let's protest in favour of it as well, which was quite confusing for the secret police who were supposed to be arresting them. All the slogans were how much we love the government, and they still had to arrest them because they knew it was irony because nobody did love the government. And the gnomes was, instead of saying that you had all these blank spaces, which in every country, of course, if people have painted anti-government graffiti, it will get painted over in the repressive governments, obviously. So all these white spaces, and usually more political graffiti got filled in on there, instead of which they had these pretty gnomes, the red hats they're called in Polish. They looked like kind of the same word as for Disney dwarfs, the krasnoludki, meaning the red little people. So you'd have people with little red hats and flowers and looking very cheerful, and the police kind of, okay, well, we better paint that out as well. But you didn't quite know what you were painting out because it didn't seem to be subversive. You then had demonstrations of dwarfs, and the famous slogan, which was a rhyming slogan in Polish, was without solidarity there is no freedom. Bez solidarności nie ma wolności. So it was a great chant at the illegal protest. And they flipped it and they said, without dwarfs there is no freedom. And they were dressed up as well, without dwarfs there is no freedom, without dwarfs there is no freedom. And a very favourite radio message was heard coming from the police van saying, arrest all the dwarfs, arrest all the dwarfs, arrest all the dwarfs. And it's a fun thing, but the serious bit that comes out of that is, like, only a year later, Solidarity, which I mentioned, was indeed re-legalized, led to a democratic government, and after that came the Berlin Wall. So I like to think it was kind of Sneezy and Grumpy who made the wall come down.
Tell me about the applause or non-applause protest.
Yes, and also a favourite one of that. In fact, an early version of the book was actually called Forbidden Applause, was the working title. This is in Belarus, sometimes called the last dictatorship in Europe. I mean, we've still got this guy, Lukashenko, who is trampling human rights left, right and centre. Again, it picks up, I mean, in their own way, but it has that sense of irony again. Massively unpopular. So what the Belarusians decided to do was to come together for not even meetings, but you just stand in a square, stand somewhere in a public place, and you would start clapping. And you're supposed to be clapping the president. And again, people got arrested because the people arresting knew that you weren't really clapping the president. So they got arrested. So people would stand around clapping, saying, our president, and clapping, and you'd get arrested for that. And the nice twist that goes with that is that when he was giving some big speech and all of his bureaucrats sitting, and normally they would do this massive applause of, yes, the great man has spoken, and they kind of didn't quite like to applaud that year, because if they did that, they might seem to be a bit like the protesters who were being arrested. So again, a nice way, real dangers, people were arrested, they were beaten, they suffered greatly, but their way past it was finding that humour that goes with it, which is truly amazing.
Of course, art has always played a big part in protest. Mm. And you have this wonderful quote about how art isn't political or not political, it's just life.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting, I think, the role that creatives play in different places. It's one of many reasons why I was so thrilled and grateful Ai Weiwei agreed to write the preface. Because he's an artist, but he's political, but he's just kind of, he is what he is. He's like telling truths, and that's what art does. It tells truths, and life overlaps with politics in that sense. Another lovely quote that he has, which is an old one, but I'm fond of that one, of never retreat, retweet, he says, which, you know, sounds like a flip line, but of course is not. So yes, film directors, painters, filmmakers especially played a very important role. In Iran today, we have Jafar Panahi, who's been locked up basically for daring to start to make a film which was about the 2009 protests. And so that became a kind of a crime in itself. How dare you tell the truth, basically. And he then came out with films like something called This Is Not a Film, which it was lovely because he was banned from filmmaking. So he made a film and gave it the name This Is Not a Film, which again was like, OK, lock me up if you want. But it was so very gently daring, again, with lovely Iranian humour, which is very, very powerful.
Steve, of course, we're seeing a great wave of protest again engulfing the war now. Now, this programme's recorded a couple of weeks in advance. Who knows what will have happened in Romania by the time it goes out.
Yes.
But one thing that's particularly struck me is the Women's March and the fact that suddenly we are seeing this huge resurgence. And I wondered if you could give us one piece of advice to people who want to change the way that they're governed. Particularly now when we're looking at a democratically elected leader or so-called leader or so-called democratically elected leader, how one might go about actually changing that government.
Yeah, and you're right. It's protest is now everywhere in our minds, which is faintly bizarre to me. When I was writing this book last year, there were moments, you know, every author has these moments like, who's ever going to want to read this? And I'm thinking, does anybody except me really care about protest at all? You know, I'm fascinated for all the reasons we've been discussing. And then, you know, it gets published now. Usually every author is thrilled when his or her book seems so relevant. To be honest, I would, in this sense, slightly trade it away that we wouldn't need to protest so much. But you're right. Protest is very much in the air, and as anyone who's been on any of the recent protests will know, it is incredibly inspiring to be part of it. It's also very weird that that protest is so necessary in a way that we're more familiar with from non-democracies. And so that's the kind of paradox I think we're really facing, that in a repressive place where people then get beaten up, it becomes crystallized and forces, and you know what your ending is going to be, roughly speaking. It's a change and you get the change. Here, the guy who is, you know, insert dreadful adjectives here, but has been democratically elected. Glitches in there, but fundamentally democratically elected and fundamentally within what seemed until now to be a functioning democracy. So I suppose all I would really say is that none of us should think that protest is irrelevant. I mean, we all know examples of where big protests have not gone anywhere, and they could be saying this as well. But I love what, again, we actually close the, I close the book with another, an older Ai Weiwei quotation, which is, I think, truly wonderful, which says, imagine one day the hateful world around you collapses, and it's your attitude, words, and actions that put an end to it. Will you be excited? And that sense of we ought to believe, we need to believe, we can believe and create change, I think it's incredibly important for all of us.
Listeners, you know what you need to do. Steve Crawshaw, thank you so much. Street Spirit, The Power of Protest and Mischief by Steve Crawshaw, with a foreword by Ai Weiwei, is published by Lom Art, an imprint of Michael O'Mara Books. It's available now, and it's a definite must read. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Sai Villaferte. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. You can also subscribe for free so you never miss an episode. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.